right, excellent. Okay, so I was told this was supposed to just start a discussion. So I guess I also want to preface the remarks by saying that the completely obvious things, that obviously the most important thing to be thinking about with the Higgs at the moment is completely phenomenological, about determining as well as we can what its couplings are, how standard model-like it is. As I understand from the discussion yesterday, if it's even, you know, has spin zero, et cetera, et cetera. Although, you know, if the Higgs has spin two, then I think I'll just quit physics. It's not obvious the world is worth understanding, you know? Like, we have a finite lifetime, and I would do other things if the Higgs has spin two. But anyway, so it will not have spin two. If the Higgs-like politically correct particle has spin two, and if it's a technidilaton, I will not only quit physics, but actually kill myself. I know. I've suffered under these recordings before, but that was for you, technidilaton people. You know that. Because that would just be the most royal fuck you could possibly get from nature. So I think I will not. Hopefully that's not true. Anyway, so for the purpose of this talk, I'm going to. But we do, of course, have to. Not kidding aside, we have to make sure that it's the Higgs. We have to make sure that it's even close to the standard model and start determining how close the couplings are to the standard model. And I hope one of the things that is going to be discussed, and I understand will be discussed at length in this meeting, are questions like the following. So, you know, probably by the end of this year, will we know, or analyzing the data that's all the data available, will we know the Higgs couplings to 40%? You know, broadly speaking, it's likely we'll know them to 40-30%. But exactly how well we'll know them is an important question. Obviously, asymptotically, will we know them to 10%? That's maybe stretching it, but experimentalists get more and more clever as there's more and more data. What's the fantasy we could imagine for how well we could nail these couplings at the LHC? And whatever ones we can nail, you know, as optimistically as we can. Let's say that the fantasy is true and we can nail them to 10%. Okay, then I think there's a very important question for enthusiasts of Higgs factories and so on. When people talk about, look, we should then go ahead and build the Higgs factory, then we'll measure these couplings to 3% or 2%. That's great, but I think a really serious question, which I don't know the answer to, and I hope the collected wisdom of the people at a meeting like this could enlighten at least me, if not other people, experts who know it, is not so much will we be able to use a putative Higgs factory to put limits on deviations at the 3% level, but would we be convinced if there is a deviation, you know, if there's a deviation at the 2% level, would we be convinced that it's seen? Or would it be another muon g-2, another one of the infinite number of things where it might always be in this fog of is it or isn't it? Okay? And I think that's a really crucial question. You know, it's to my mind, that's an absolutely crucial question to settle. Because as with muon g-2, it's not completely obvious that shrinking the error bars permanently is teaching us a lot. To me, the really central question is not to compare a linear collider against a Higgs factor against the LHC for how well they can set limits, but to use a higher standard for the for Higgs factor to see if there are deviations at this small level, could we actually be convinced that it's there and real? And you know, that is literally will literally be the billions of dollar question, because if there is a, that's the ultimate point. If we see the Higgs and nothing else, well, that's going to be the theme of the talk is going to be naturalness, the implications of Higgs at 125 GeV for naturalness. But if we just imagine this scenario that we see the Higgs and nothing else, at least for a while, the intellectual point of continuing is to figure out, is there a next scale? Where is the next scale? And what are the higher dimension operators involving the Higgs, which is the guy that's unnatural? What kind of limits can we put on them, right? That's I think becomes the absolute central question. For instance, lots of those higher dimension operators, the ones that are associated with precision electroweak physics, we already know are bounded by pretty high scales. Can we do better than that? I learned something wonderful from a wonderful way of saying something I knew from Scott Thomas recently, that just the limits, just the fact that the Higgs gamma-gamma rate is within a factor of 2 of the standard model is already putting better limits on precision electroweak operators than the entire LEP program. Okay? And that shows you how what a great idea it is to produce a damn particle. Okay? But it's very easy for anyone to appreciate this fact. All of you, including me, all of us who have been playing games, putting in charged particles running around the loop to enhance Higgs gamma gamma, all of us have checked the S parameter and it's fine. Okay? The fact that the S parameter is totally fine, you read it backwards, it tells you that actually, if it was not fine, we'd be getting a much larger correction to Higgs gamma gamma. So this is quite remarkable. Simply, you know, nailing these things to a factor of 2 has already wiped out LEP as far as limits on some combinations of precision electroweak operators. So how well can we do? That's the logical question. The reason we want to measure these couplings well is if we're in the situation where we have the Higgs and nothing else, is we want to figure out what the higher dimension operators are, what scale they might be suppressed by, and how well can we do doing that. And again, just saying it one more time, finding limits on that is very important. Finding limits on it tells us something about how fine-tuned the theory is, at least in some qualitative sense. But in the other direction, finding something is the future of the entire damn subject, right? So that's why we have to be completely convinced that some putative machine is going to do much, much better at putting limits, but that we would be convinced if it found a positive result. So that's those are, to my mind, the really important questions. But first of all, there are people who are more expert on these questions than me. And secondly, I hope they are being discussed already by other people at this meeting. So I will talk about a somewhat more meta set of questions that are the implications of the theoretical implications of having the Higgs at 125 GeV and what it tells us about, what it might tell us about naturalness. Okay. Oh, I should just say one thing, maybe even before getting into that. This is a bit of a side comment, but just to point out the importance of even measuring Higgs branching ratios to the 50% level. Okay, not sigma times branching ratio, but just absolute branching ratios at the 50% level. I think it's true that given the data today, the Higgs could have a 50% invisible branching ratio, and we wouldn't know it. Right? So we'd ultimately have to look for it in vector boson fusion. That's going to be a while. Of course, we can't just deplete everything by a factor of 2, because that would screw up all the rates. But we imagine there's something else enhancing the glue-glue rate a little bit. So we could have a 50% invisible branching ratio. Okay, that's pretty important. And there's totally reasonable models of dark matter, for example, that would predict order 50% branching ratios. If any of you are excited, I am not at all, but if any of you are excited about cogent and light dark matter and stuff like that, there's a completely trivial class of models that would explain this. Even without writing down any formulas, it's obvious, right? They want like a 7 GeV dark matter particle, okay? Now, 7 GeV, uncolored, gives you a branching, it talks to the Higgs, it's getting its mass, maybe I should say that, sorry. So I don't want to spend too much time on this, but let me just say something quickly about it. So here's a trivial class of theories, just a trivial, and many people have written things like this down, I think, but I just want to say it in a sort of a symmetry language. Here's a trivial class of theories that give you roughly the kind of signal these guys are talking about. You want light dark matter, lighter than the weak scale, with big, 10 to the minus 41 centimeter squared cross-sections against nuclei. So here's a trivial set of theories that could do it. Imagine that the dark matter is charged under under a PQ symmetry. So that because it's charged, you can't have a mass for the dark matter particle, but you could have this kind of higher dimension operator, which you could get by integrating some stuff out at the weak scale. So M is suppressed by the weak scale. If the PQ is a good symmetry, B mu with or without Susie, but let's imagine. B mu is small, okay? So this is explicitly breaking the PQ symmetry. And that gives rise to that gives rise to an expectation value for H up, H down, which is roughly the weak V squared over M. This is all the weak scale, parametrically 1 over 10 beta psi psi. Okay, so tan beta is big because B mu is small. It's a symmetry limit. That means that this dark matter is light. It's light by a tan beta factor relative to the weak scale. So that's why it could be down naturally at 5.7 GeV. Okay, so really, this thing is turning into, this is telling us that the dark matter, because of the PQ symmetry, is ultimately getting its mass from a higher dimension operator like that. Okay. There's an epsilon in front of it because psi carries a PQ charge. So psi carries a PQ charge, which would forbid this. So that's why you put a small epsilon there, which comes from the breaking of PQ. OK, very good. So this means that if all these scales are the weak scale, the Higgs is giving this guy its mass, just like it gives the B its mass. And so you'd expect a 50%, an order one branching ratio to this guy. It could be a little smaller. It could be a little bigger. But actually, all other things being equal, 4.5, 5 GeV with three colors is the same as 7 GeV with no colors. So you'd expect an order 50% branching ratio, invisible branching ratio of the Higgs going to this stuff. And by the way, the same PQ symmetry explains why this thing can have a big cross-section. 10 to the minus 41 centimeter squared type cross-section is needed, because if you put that Higgs to its VEV, the exchange of the second Higgs is unsuppressed by the mass. If you like, there's a 10 beta enhancement relative to what you'd naively expect. And so you get a big cross-section, much bigger than normal Higgs exchange. So the qualitative features of this dark matter signal, that you need a light dark matter particle with a big cross-section, is just a simple consequence of the existence of a PQ symmetry down at low scales. OK, very good. So it's not a crazy, stupid set of theories. And it's totally reasonable to expect an order 50% invisible branching ratio. And today, a 50% invisible branching ratio is fine. So we should be able to do better than that, hopefully. So it's not even just a matter, I just wanted to mention this, because it's not even obviously just a matter of putting better limits on couplings and so on. We might discover actually something new and important. And of course, if we see a 50% invisible branching ratio for the Higgs, I would believe that 10 times more than 10 more experiments of this dark matter sort reporting inconclusive signals for the next decade. Okay? All right. So I now want to turn to the question of 125 GeV Higgs and naturalness. And I guess the first thing to say, I mean, it's so obvious, but I'll say it anyway. This isn't important to remind experts like everyone here, but I think it is a little important to talk about it, to mention this when we describe what's important about the Higgs to people outside particle physics, is that it's completely shocking that an elementary Higgs is responsible for electric weak symmetry breaking. It should be shocking. It's a historical accident that it happened to be the simplest field theory models that 10 people discovered 50 years ago. Okay. But it's shocking. It's really shocking. In other parts of physics where we have this phenomenon where we have analogous phenomenon, like in superconductivity, it is not the Higgs. It's strong dynamics. That's why, if you're really conservative, the most conservative possibility for what we should have seen for electric weak symmetry breaking was not an elementary Higgs. It should have been something like Technicolor. Okay? Something like Technicolor just should have been true. If the vacuum of the world is just like some crappy metal, exciting, fascinating metal. Okay, fascinating, highly relativistic metal that makes it so much more interesting than other metals. But anyway, let's not say that so loud. So that's right. If it's just like any other sort of system, then it should have been Technicolor. Okay, and so the fact that it isn't Technicolor is, of course, we've known that too since the late 80s and early 90s. But that's very, very surprising. And it's particularly surprising because, of course, we have seen this kind of physics before. We have seen light weakly coupled scalars describing physics before. And all the other times we've seen it elsewhere in nature, there's been a fine tuner, the experimentalists with their finger on the dials, dialing things to bring the system close to a second order phase transition. Okay? So we've seen this physics before when there's fine tuning. And so that's very surprising. It's very surprising that on the face of it, we're in that situation now. Okay? Now, of course, we've also known that argument for 30 years, 40 years, 35 years. We've been motivated by naturalness to imagine that there should be a lot of new physics at the weak scale to solve this problem. I don't want to give a long talk about the philosophy of naturalness, but I do want to say one thing about it, which is that one thing in its favor, which is that just to remind, again, not the theorists, but maybe some of the experimentalists here, that this was not some idea that was randomly invented by a bunch of theorists in the 70s to play a game called the hierarchy problem game for 3 decades until experiments came along and, you know, and whacked them across the face and told them to stop playing this silly game. There's a good reason. There's a good reason to expect something like that should happen. It happened 3 times in the previous century. In the previous century, there were 3 occasions on which we had an analogous problem. Sometimes it was recognized as such, sometimes it wasn't. But there are 3 previous times where we had something like a naturalness problem, and every single time it was solved in this way. Every single time it was solved by having new physics come in at exactly the appropriate scale. In fact, I want to say this a little bit more in detail because it serves as distinction to the current situation we're in. So the most famous example that you all know, and you've heard in hundreds of talks probably, is that 100 years ago, people had problems with the classical self-energy of the electron. Okay? So Abraham and Lorentz and people like that were very confused that there was an infinite self-energy stored in the electric field around an electron. So what did they do? They said, well, let's cut it off somewhere. Let's imagine the electron has some size A. And they equated the energy stored in the electric field, which is E squared over 4 pi A, to M electron C squared. I'm uncharacteristically leaving the C's in for a reason that will become obvious. Okay? And so there is some scale called the classical radius of the electron, which is E squared over 4 pi M electron C squared. Okay? And so they said something new has got to happen by then. That's a hierarchy problem type argument. Right? If it was much smaller than that, you'd have to imagine that there was some fine adjustment between a negative bare mass of the electron, whatever that means, and the energy stored in the electric field in order not to have problems. So it was a hierarchy problem type argument. And it was a power divergence. Here it's a linear divergence, not a quadratic divergence, but it was this argument. Now what did they do? They tried to build the theories where the electron was actually a shell, a finite size object of size A. That was the Technicolor of 1905. Okay, they were trying to make the electron composite at exactly the scale that it needed to be. And it was a disastrous failure of an idea then. But it wasn't their fault. They couldn't do any better. It didn't work for lots and lots of reasons. But the only thing that was wrong was that particular model. Okay? The basic strategy was, in fact, correct. The basic logic was correct. New physics did show up, but it was new physics that was much more exciting than they could have imagined. It was relativity and quantum mechanics. It was the particles and antiparticles out here, which cuts off the linear divergence a lot earlier. But where does it cut off the linear divergence? It cuts off the linear divergence at a size, which is h bar over m electron c, the Compton wavelength. Okay, so this is the real scale, A Compton, where the divergences are shut off. And you'll notice that A Compton is E squared over 4 pi h bar c inverse times A classical. Okay? So it's alpha inverse bigger than the classical radius. Okay? This is a really important point. The theory had a weak coupling in it, alpha, and the new physics came in earlier than it had to come in. Didn't come in right at the last possible moment. That would be stupid. The theory has a weak coupling expansion. The corrections can't be comparable if there's a weak coupling, can't be comparable to the first thing you have. They've got to be smaller. And so the new physics came in 137 times earlier than it had to come in. Okay? So even though their detailed model was wrong, their basic logic was correct, and in fact it worked. Okay? It just, what the new physics was very different than what they expected. The second example, which is a lot, the second example, which is much closer to our current situation, is the famous problem of the splitting between the charged pion and the neutral pion. Okay. So the neutral pion, if we shut off quark masses, is a Goldstone boson, but the charged pion couples to QED, and exactly the hierarchy problem diagrams that we draw for the Higgs, literally exactly the same diagrams, give you a quadratically divergent mass for the pi plus and not for the pi zero. So there's a delta m squared, which is alpha over 4 pi, some cutoff squared. Now literally the same as the hierarchy problem, completely the same. Okay. That, now again, you can make an argument that does something come in? Something has got to come in to cancel this quadratic divergence. Something does come in to cancel it. Oh, and if you put in the numbers, you need something by 1 GeV, 1.2 GeV, something like that. Something does come in. It's the Romazon. It's 770 MeV. In this case, it also comes in earlier. It may look like it's just a numerical accident. It's actually not a numerical accident. It's the same weak coupling factor. It's just the weak coupling here is 1 over n. The Romazon comes in 1 over root n earlier than it absolutely has to. That's the same argument as before. Something comes in at where it needed to. And the final argument, which is a little different but the same in spirit, is KK bar mixing. Okay? So there the charm came in. There's a low energy contribution to delta MK. It's quadratically divergent. The charm cuts it off. It could have happened that the charm and the top contributions fine-tuned against each other to keep delta MK constant. It didn't happen. In fact, again, Guyard and Lee predicted something like 2 GeV for where the charm should come in. It came in earlier than it had to. So there isn't a weak coupling factor. I don't actually quite understand why it came in earlier in that case, but it could have come in right. Actually, it's not exactly the same kind of situation. But anyway, it wasn't tuned. So three times in the last 100 years, this kind of hierarchy problem type argument either was made or could have been made, and three times it was correct. So we're not just pulling these things out of our asses when we make these arguments. But every time it's worked in the past, there has been no excuses and whining. Okay? No one said, you know, maybe it's okay that there's a contribution to the classic electron mass that's 10 times bigger than the mass of the electron. And there's, oh, it's just 10%. Oh, big deal, 10%. No one was whining about 10% tuning or spending way too much of their lives quantifying what fine-tuning really meant anyway. You know, this is just, when something works, you don't have to screw around. It just works. Okay? That's what it means when it's parametrically small. When the corrections are parametrically small, they're just not tuned, period. You don't have to talk about how tuned, this, that, or the other. Okay? That's what's different about the situation today. So when we say that natural SUSY means you should see a stop lighter than 400 GeV, full stop, which is true, okay? If you don't want any tuning, independent of the model, independent of anything, there's our top loop, and the top loop is 0.3 some cutoff squared. And if we don't want there to be any tuning, this should be comparable to 125 GeV squared. So something new has got to come in before, I don't know, three times 120, let's call it 400, okay? So we need to have some new colored particles lighter than 400 GeV. That's absolutely true, but this is the analog of the technicolor. This is the analog of something new coming in at the classical electron radius. The theory is a small coupling parameter. You know, if it was really actually natural, the stop should have weighed the top, okay? Not three times heavier. But nonetheless, it's okay. This is still not a disaster at all. Okay? It's okay, but it already shows that things are different. And certainly, if these guys are a TeV or 1.5 TeV, and we start talking about is 10% okay or not okay and stuff like that, that even might be the way nature works. I'm not saying that's not the way nature works. But that represents a break from when these arguments worked in the past. When these arguments worked in the past, there was no whining and there was no excuses. No one was talking about what the correct measure of tuning should be for the self-energy of the electron stored in its electric field.
What would you say about the binding energy?
Oh, I would say, actually, thank you for asking. Thank you, Anne. Thank you for answering that. So as anyone knows, you can use the history of physics to illustrate any polemical point that you want to make, okay? which is why it's dangerous to base anything on history. But actually, the question Anne just asked right now is a very good one, which will dovetail into what I want to talk about anyway. So okay, here we're going on and on about naturalness at the weak scale. But let's just go one energy scale down from the electroweak scale to nuclear physics. And nuclear physics is just fine-tuned. Okay, that's why it's so hard for stupid people like me to learn. That's why you get so confused when you start first learning nuclear physics. If you're just a dumb guy, you say, oh, you know, these guys are going to bind. So we have a proton, we have two protons, three protons, four protons. We just put them on top of each other, protons and neutrons. That's not what you see in nature. What you see, some of them are there, some of them aren't there. And you think it's because, you know, there's some hyper-genius nuclear theorist working things out. No, it's just fine-tuned. It's just an accident. And that's why nuclear physics is a little bit complicated and hard to understand. So there's actually two important fine-tunings in nuclear physics. As far as I can tell, they're independent from each other. One of them is the one that Anne alluded to, that the binding energy of the deuteron is 2 MeV. It's a lot smaller than all the other scales in nuclear physics. Okay? And I think if you ask, whenever I ask a nuclear theorist, why is the deuteron binding energy so small, I was like, well, there's just a 5% level cancellation between the kinetic and potential energies of the proton and neutron and the deuteron. It's just a fine-tuning. There's one more fine-tuning, which is actually a lot more dramatic than that. So two neutrons are not bound. Okay, they're not bound. You can ask, how much are they not bound by? Or the way to say it more professionally is, what's the nucleon-nucleon scattering length? Okay, which is the inverse of how much they're not bound by. Do you know what it is? Well, Maxime knows everything. But 60 keV. KeV. It comes within a hair's breadth of being bound, and it isn't bound. That's an independent accident. I think Maxime, maybe you can correct me, but I think there's two channels. There's an isosinglet and an isotriplet channel. There's a 4-4 Fermi interaction for both of them. And both of them are fine-tuned. One of them, the one for the deuteron is fine-tuned, binding energy is fine-tuned to maybe 5%. This one's fine-tuned to more like a part in 500. Okay? That's just the next energy scale down. We go on and on about how everything should look hypernatural. There it is. That effective theory has two fine-tunings in it. If you multiply them because they're independent, it's already a part in 10,000. Okay? Okay, so that, now, and furthermore, what do these fine-tunings, so when polemicists talk about fine-tuning and the anthropic principle and this and that and the other, one thing certain polemicists will say is that the spectrum of nuclei and the strong interactions, people could have said that that's anthropically determined, and they were idiots, because in the end, it was beautifully described by QCD, and everything was determined from first principles and everything. And it's true, but the part that was determined by QCD and first principles is the part that sort of is totally irrelevant for these arguments. The ratio of the rho meson mass to the proton mass is beautifully predicted by QCD, thank you very much. But these fine-tunings have everything to do not with the QCD part, but with the electroweak symmetry breaking part, with the up and down quark masses. Okay? It's exactly the electroweak symmetry part breaking infection of nuclear physics, which is where all these fine tunings are coming from. Okay? So not only we go one scale down, we see tunings, but those tunings have to do with, guess what, the physics of electroweak symmetry breaking. Okay? Are you trying to get me in trouble, Marty? Well, they're not just polemicists. They're fine physicists a million times better than me. But still, it doesn't make them right. Okay, so all of this is to say that, you know, we have arguments that naturalness should work. From history, we have indications there's something maybe funny in nuclear physics that's related to the physics of electroweak symmetry breaking somehow. And then, by the way, if we open our eyes a little more, there's the other funny facts about nuclear physics that I didn't even mention, which are sort of related to the ones that we talked about. But these are the ones that get a little more press as far as the question of whether there may be anthropic selection for the weak scale, it's things like the existence of atoms. You know, the existence of atoms is a very delicate accident. If we change the weak, if we keep everything fixed and we increase the value of the weak scale, then the down quark starts getting heavier and heavier compared to the up quark, such that at some point the neutron gets so much heavier than the proton that the neutron-proton mass splitting exceeds nuclear binding energies. Again, the near equality of these mass splittings and nuclear binding energies is a total accident. They have nothing to do with each other. They're not parametrically the same as each other. And in fact, if you increase the weak scale by a factor of 3, there's no atoms. Okay? You just have hydrogen. Everything else decays. Right? That didn't have to be the case. But we're close to these pretty dangerous limits. I'll just make a small comment because it's a kind of a cool physics point. If we go the other way, and we say that there's no Higgs, so we know, unlike what we tell the world, the Higgs is utterly irrelevant to giving the W and the Z masses, right? In a world with no Higgs, we have beautiful W and Z masses from QCD. Okay? So we get they're just 100 times lighter than they would have been. So why didn't that happen? You know, why didn't we have a world just where the Higgs mass is what it is, but we just flip its sign, even? Never mind making it much, much heavier. QCD could have broken electroweak symmetry. Why didn't it? Well, the world would have also been dramatically different then for different reasons. First of all, the fermions would be a lot lighter. Okay? That's not so crucial, actually. But what I think is really interesting is in that world, sphalerons are not shut off by electroweak symmetry breaking. So there's no baryons. Okay? The world is filled with my least favorite particle, the neutrino. After everything goes through, the sphalerons aren't shut off. They just keep going. The W is lighter than the proton. Okay, so you just exponentially suppress the baryon abundance, and so nothing. So if we just let the strong interactions break electroweak symmetry, that would have been fine, but it would be impossible to have a world with baryons. Okay, so all of this argues in the end that it's not ridiculous to entertain the possibility that the physics at the weak scale won't end up being natural. And just to lay my cards on the table, like many of the model builders in this room, I've spent almost all my professional life thinking about this problem. And my feeling is that we could be learning two things from the collection of everything that's come out of the LHC so far. Either there really is a natural theory out there, and it's a little bit elaborate. It's more complicated than the ones that we had been imagining were true. Could well be there, but it's not the first thing that you would have done. Doesn't mean that it's wrong. A lot of the standard model is not the first thing that you would have done. The second two generations are not the first thing you would have done, and so on. But you know, every time I go back and remind myself what those theories look like, I remember why I didn't like them so much to begin with. But anyway, doesn't mean that it's wrong. So the world could be natural, but somewhat elaborate. You know, this is sort of elaborate in the space of models, if not in the space of couplings and parameters. Or it could be simple and unnatural. Okay, so I think that to my mind is the take-home message. Now, simple and unnatural could just be the standard model and nothing else, all the way up to the Planck scale. But I think that's way, way too much. That's really a humongous amount of fine-tuning for electroweak symmetry breaking. I think there are probably, if there is fine-tuning for electroweak symmetry breaking, maybe we can take some clue from these nuclear physics accidents what kinds of tunings we're talking about. You know, we're not talking about 1 part in 10 to the 30 type tunings, but 1 part in 100, 1 part in 1,000, 1 part in 10,000, 1 part in a million, you know, somewhere in that range seems reasonable. And these numbers, 1 part in 10,000, 1 part in a million, are, you know, they're chump change compared to the 10 to the 120, 10 to the 60 type tunings that we're talking about for the cosmological constant. And even the 10 to the 30 type tunings that we're talking about as far as the hierarchy problem is concerned. Okay? So there's this kind of intermediate level of meso tuning, which is very tuned from the point of view of natural physics, but I think is very likely chump change from the point of view of an underlying theory that would allow you to make sense of these tunings, which is the sort of thing which is, I think, reasonable to expect. And then there is no reason to throw out all of these wonderful successes we had with low energy supersymmetry, with gauge coupling unification and dark matter and so on. So my sense, my feeling is that if it's simple, then what we're talking about is a fine-tuned version of low energy supersymmetry with this parametrically one loop splitting between the gauginos and the scalars. With the scalars, with the first two generations somewhere in the neighborhood of thousands of TeV. The third generation could be around there, it could be 5-10 times lighter than that for a variety of reasons. So 100 to 1,000 TeV scalars for the third generation, thousands of TeV scalars for the first two generations. When you think about this sort of minimal version of Split Susie, there's an interesting question where the Higginos are. I think it's most likely the Higginos are also up where the scalars are in this picture. So the Higginos are also up there in the hundreds to thousands of TeV range. And this picture reasonably gives you a Higgs mass of 125 GeV at low energies. You don't have to dial 10 beta to be close to 1. You don't have to rely on any accidents to make 10 beta large. 10 beta could be 2 or 3, something totally reasonable, and you get 125 GeV Higgs at low energies. Okay? Sorry? So the light particles are the Gauginos. The light particles are the Beano. So the biggest picture is that we have Susy breaking. We have a gravitino mass. Let's say this is 10 to the 2 to 3 TeV. And there's just no reason why the scalars aren't there. Okay. So the whole idea is not to be clever. Okay. It's the anti-model builder's dream of the world. Okay. Everything is as dumb as possible, but as simple as possible. There's no clever mechanism. There's no sequestering. There's no, you put this there, you put that there, you put that on the other side of this brain wrapped around a 17 torus with 4 holes in it. Okay? There's just, you just run the stupidest possible story. You break Susy in the hidden sector, there. Okay? That's fine. Susy's broken, the scalars have a mass. Nothing stops them, no symmetry stops them, they have a mass. The Gaugino, something stops them. You have to also break R symmetry. If you have singlets in the hidden sector and you arrange that the couplings are there correctly, of course you can get the Gauginos comparable to everyone else. That's what we'd been assuming for 20 years, that's reasonable. But it's worth remembering that all the people building concrete Susy breaking models from the day one, 1980, 1981, 1982, were not getting spectra that look like that. Because why? You have to also break R symmetry. After you break Susy. So they all had this pattern of either massless Gauginos or Gauginos that were loop factor suppressed compared to the scalars. This is not a new thing. There's nothing about these models that's new. You know, many people have run into this spectrum time and time again, going back to the very earliest days of models of Susy breaking. The modern incarnation was with anomaly mediation, okay, where you think about hidden sector Susy breaking. And as almost all of you know, there were two wonderful papers on anomaly mediation in 99. There was a paper by the CERN group and the Randall and Sundrum paper. And most people's reaction was that the Randall and Sundrum paper got something clever and correct because they discovered this picture of sequestering that allowed you to have the scalars and the Gauginos degenerate. Whereas the CERN group had the scalars up at 100 or 1,000 TeV, had much lighter Gauginos. They were very embarrassed by it. They were so embarrassed by it that they tried as hard as they could to say, oh, it's maybe 20 TeV, it's not so bad. But you know, they just had a splitting. They just had a splitting, and that's life. That's what they got. So this is not a new spectrum. This is something that the people have run into time and time again. What's novel is the thought to take it seriously as a possibility for something that might actually happen. This happens naturally from the top down. It's fine-tuned. It's fine-tuned at about this level. It depends exactly where the scalars are. If they're at 100 or 1,000 TeV, the fine-tuning is maybe a part in 10,000, a part in 100,000, a part in a million, you know, in the ballpark of the kind of things we were talking about beforehand that we've perhaps seen already in nuclear physics. Yes? Yes, right.
They give you those sorts of numbers.
Yes, yes.
And the difference in strength between the scale is 246 GeV versus lambda QCD, which
right.
is the same number we're looking at.
Right.
Are you proposing that there's actually two phenomena that are going on?
No, I think ultimately they're all the same phenomenon. So if the reason why you can ask, why are you fine tuning here for electroweak symmetry breaking? What's driving that tuning? If what you have in mind for what's driving the tuning is some kind of anthropic explanation for what the weak scale is, then all of these things become related to each other. Because it is important for things like the neutron-proton mass splitting to be comparable to the scales of nuclear binding energies and so on. But ultimately, the sort of proximity between the QCD scale and the weak scale up to factors of alpha is the same thing that's showing up in all of these things, okay? Including the ones I was talking about before, okay? So I think it's plausible that it's the same kind of parametrics which is controlling all of them, okay? There are scales that a priori have nothing to do with each other, the weak scale and the QCD scale, and there's something which is intermingling them in order to make all this interesting structure that we see around us. But, you know, the A word is just purely used as motivation here. Now we can forget it. Okay, now we can totally forget it. I just want you to take the spectrum seriously. Okay? That this is what wants to happen from the top down. Now, you could say this is what wants to happen from the top down. You want to have a one-loop splitting between the scalars and the Gaginos. Fantastic. Why didn't we have Gaginos discovered 30 years ago at 1 GeV and at 2 GeV? And of course, as the older generation than mine will remember, they were discovered at CERN in 1984 or 1985, these 5 GeV, 4 GeV gluinos, before they were undiscovered, like so many other things back then. But it's perfectly possible. So I'm not giving you an answer for why that most why the spectrum wasn't realized in a natural way, you know. And for this, we could have a discussion about this that I don't want to have. This is now a much more meta discussion, even than this one, of pressures and what might the scale go up or down. Or I can say lots of stories for what makes it more or less plausible that it wasn't realized in its most natural incarnation. But it's irrelevant for the actual physical observables that we want to be talking about. So what I want to say is this one loop splitting is totally reasonable. The novelty now is that what we're learning from experiments is if that's what the spectrum looks like, it's going to be an unnatural theory. Okay? This is targeted at a comment for the experimentalists, but some beyond the standard model theorists are giving our field a bad name by constantly changing the goalposts and saying, oh, we said it should be discovered right now. Oh, it wasn't discovered. We didn't mean that after all. It should actually be discovered a little bit later. No, it wasn't discovered then. No, actually, we didn't mean that either. Just next time. I want to say two things about that. First of all, this is a general physics point. Theories need to be consistent, not theorists. Okay. Okay. So that's just a fact. It doesn't matter. You know, somebody can be a jackass. Someone can be a nice guy. It doesn't matter. What matters is what the theory actually does. Okay. But secondly, there are some theorists, at least, who have not been changing their story. And you know, this is in this context, this model, this exactly this version. Exactly this one loop splitting, exactly the Higgsinos up there, everything that I told you was already, like I said, the CERN group ran into it, other people ran into it, but was even said in an unembarrassed way by a variety of people back, you know, in 2003, 2004, 2005, and has not been changing. Okay? So this is the simplest possible way this story could work. We can start working out its consequences. It could have easily been falsified already. It would have been falsified if the Higgs was 115 GeV. Okay? And it's fine now. It's passed one small test. Okay, it's passed one small test that just what is reasonable in a reasonable range of its parameters. I think it would have reasonably predicted this minimal version, the maximal version of Swift-Susie would have predicted a Higgs mass between 120 and 150 GeV. This more minimal version is probably a little more compressed between 120 and 140, and so something at around 125 is in a perfectly comfortable, reasonable place for it. So that's as I said, that's from the point of view of just putting my cards on the table. That if you woke me up in the middle of the night and said, what do I think is going on at the weak scale? I think that's what's going on at the weak scale. Or it could be more elaborate. Of course, it'd be much more fun if it was natural and more elaborate. We'd have a lot more fun sorting it out. And if that's what's going on, I would be as happy as everyone else. But in my heart of hearts, I hope that I hope that nature isn't Baroque, that it chooses to give us something simple but with an important lesson in it. If something like this is going on, we learn something fairly dramatic about the world at the weak scale, that fine-tuning actually happens, and we have to learn to deal with it somehow, and that nature chooses simplicity and tuning over naturalness and baroquosity. Is that a word? I'm not sure. Okay. Baroqueness. Thank you. Well, baroquosity is an example of a baroqueness. You see, you can take the boy out of model building land, but you can't take model building land out of the boy. All right. So let me just say a few things about this before I come back and start talking about the Higgs properties. So Matthias asked, in this most minimal version, what are the light particles? So we could have Beanos, Weanos, and Gluinos, and Higgsinos. Okay. So that's those are the things that could be protected by an R symmetry. And it is hard to separate these guys from each other by much more than a loop factor. Just because if you make this too much heavier, it feeds these guys. If you make this too much heavier, it feeds those guys. So you could have as much as a one loop splitting between these guys as well. Okay? And the most minimal version, which I think is the most plausible, has even these guys hoofed. Okay, so these guys are also gone and are up with the scalars. Okay? So we have the scalars, we have the gravitino, and the scalars, and the mu, all in the 100 to 1,000, 10 to the 2 to 10 to the 3 TeV range. Now, thousands of TeV is also the place, of course, where we solve the flavor problem. The supersymmetric flavor problem is just gone. And I just want to make a small point here, which is, so there are a bunch of small, none of these things are a big deal all by themselves. They're all individually small points, but they're all a little bit amusing and all sort of go to painting a more consistent story. So if the Higgsinos are light, it turns out that you can't make the scalars. If you want to have the Higgs mass come at around 125 GeV, then it's most reasonable with the scalar masses at 100 TeV. If you want to push the scalar masses to 1,000 TeV, you can do it, but you have to really dial tan beta to 1 so that at the high scale you start with a vanishing quarter coupling and inherit everything from running off the top quark. Okay? And that makes it hard to imagine that that's just solving the flavor problem flat out, which really needs scalars in the thousands of TeV range, just so you don't have to think about it, right? And again, this is the whole point here. We don't want to think about it. We don't want to say the scalars are 20 TeV and they're a little degenerate and this and that. We just want to say, just done. They're brainlessly fine. Okay? There's no cleverness. There's no anything. Okay. By the way, this allows all kinds of nice theories of flavor to be totally reasonable, like theories like, you know, like the theories that you and David Wright talked about a long time ago, Anne, where you have anomalous U1s to do Froggatt-Nielsen. Totally reasonable theories, very simple, no complicated charge assignments, totally fine. Would just give you order one splitting between the first two generation scalars. I'm saying take that order one splitting and put it at 1,000 TeV, everything is fine. Okay, there's nothing wrong with those theories. No problems of flavor of any sort. And you get a nice theory for the fermion mass hierarchy. Okay, so, but that picture seems hard to realize if the Higgsinos are light, because that would make the Higgs too heavy. But if the Higgsinos are heavy with where the scalars are, then the low energy Higgs mass just comes out a little bit smaller, because the quarter coupling doesn't receive a contribution from the Higgsino loop running to lower energies. And now it's completely okay with scalars in the thousands of TeV range, with, like I said, the scales could be thousands of TeV, 10 beta could be 3, everything is fine. Okay? But you put the Higgsinos up there and it makes life better. You put the Higgsinos up there and gauge coupling unification is wonderful. Okay? You know, there's all these things are small points, but we all know SUSY, gauge unification at 2 loops. You need a slightly big-ish threshold at the gut scale. It's not a big deal. It's all perfectly wonderful and great. But you know, alpha S at MZ is like 1 to 8. Okay, at 2 loops in SUSY. Alpha S at MZ here is 115. Okay, with the Higgsinos up there, just great. Okay. So that's some. I think that's some circumstantial support apart from that. It's easier to realize from the top down of putting mu up there with everyone else. And that's totally consistent with the Higgs mass at around 125. Now, let me just make some quick comments about these guys, because this is what you'd have to see at the, yeah. There's no mu problem. Mu is comparable to the scalar masses. It needs to be, otherwise you can't fine-tune the Higgs to be light. Actually, you could imagine it either way. You could imagine that there's just a Judiciary mass zero mass for mu. Done. No, it doesn't require there being a singlet at all. No, I just write down H up, H down in the Kähler potential. Done. That's utterly trivial. Because I don't want, exactly because I want to have the mu close to the gravitational mass. And that's exactly what happens. You just put H up, H down in the Kähler potential, and you're done. But actually, even if it's supersymmetric, you see, now that we're tuning, even if it's supersymmetric, it makes sense. Maybe mu is big, but we have to tune to get the Higgs light. If mu is much bigger than the soft masses, you can't do it because the Higgs mass squares are just positive. So it can only work when mu gets tuned to be close to the scalar masses. But then there's no point to tune much, much further down. So whether or not you get it from Judiciary mass zero, or it's just there as a hard supersymmetric mass. So once you're tuning for electric weak symmetry breaking, mu and the scalar masses just have to be tied to each other. There's no reason for them to be much lighter. They could be much lighter, but the simplest thing would be that they're close to where the scalar masses are. Did that make sense, what I just said? I mean, you know, even so, we're tuning now. We're unabashedly tuning. But because mu gives a universal positive mass score to everyone, it must be in the neighborhood of where the scalar masses are. Otherwise, you can't break electric weak symmetry. No, I'm not talking about any singlets anywhere. It's just hidden sector Susie breaking. Hidden sector Susie breaking, even if you want, scan a supersymmetric mu term, mass for the mu term. You're fine-tuning, so you know somewhere in this landscape, mostly the Higgs mass squared is positive, there's no electric symmetry breaking. In that universe, there's no baryons for the reason I talked about before. And then you go down, never mind atoms and everything else, then you go down, 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 down until it's in the neighborhood of where the scalars are. All right. So, yeah. So these are the guys that we have to make at the LHC. And I won't go through in detail. I won't go in detail what the signals are because I want to talk more about the Higgs. But I just want to make a qualitative point. These are all, yeah. Nope. No, the gravitinos decay before BBN. There's no moduli problem. In fact, the late decays of the gravitino can actually dilute the axion, so you can even get rid of most of the axion problem. You're tuning. We are tuning. No, so if we have moduli, we have late decaying moduli. They can dilute everything. They can dilute all the problems that we had, and they can even dilute the axion. But they're very late decaying because there are hundreds of TeV one over M Planck moduli. So they're decaying somewhat before BBN. Yeah. Right. Yes. Yes. Yes, indeed. Well, that's. I'm sure you will. I'm certainly will. But I do want to say at least in my picture of how this works, it's actually important that you're allowed to go up to thousands of TeV because I just want to solve the flavor problem without thinking about it. Right. And it makes a difference. Okay, well, you know much more about string theory than I do, and you'll explain it to all of us then. So I just want to make an interesting point, that if you have this kind of particle content, you can produce them through the standard model gauge interaction, except the Beano. But they can't decay, they can't have any marginal, they can't have any dimensionless couplings to the standard model. They have to decay through higher dimension operators. This is just incredibly cool, because you know, we've gone 50 years, 60, 70 years since we last saw a higher dimension operator in the weak interactions, okay? So that was amazing for those people. They had a clue for where the next scale was because they saw a higher dimension operator. For 30 years, we've been looking for one of these damn higher dimension operators in all the various tests we've been trying to do for what might be lying at the weak scale. If this kind of picture is true, if we produce these particles, which we can produce through the standard model gauge interactions, at least the we know and the glue we know. If they decay at all in the detector, we're seeing in front of our eyes higher dimension operators. And those higher dimension operators cannot be too far away. In fact, if the gluino decays inside the detector at all, the scale of the higher dimension operator is less than 1,000 TeV. Okay? And then actually, if we measure the displacement, if we see an observable displacement, it's got to be in that neighborhood, 100 to 1,000 TeV. Okay? If it's prompt, then the scale is even lower than 1,000 TeV. In this kind of model, that's coming in this sort of model, it's coming from integrating out the stops at tree level, the stops of the squarks at tree level. So that was the signal, the sort of smoking gun for Split Susie that we talked about a long time ago, were these long-lived gluinos. Here we're talking about long-lived gluinos with moderate displacements, not these things that sail into the detector and decay a month later. We're talking about millimeter scale, centimeter scale displacements, because the scale is not high. The scale isn't 10 to the 10 TeV. Right? The scale can at most be the sort of parametrically one loop factor, 100 to 1,000 TeV scale. Okay? But so these guys decay through higher dimension operators. So do the electroweak guys. This is something also very, very interesting. So So first, there's purely from the top down. Purely from the top down, the simplest way of running these theories, hidden sector, Susie breaking, anomaly mediation, all the usual stuff, no sequestering, nothing special, gives you that parametrically one loop splitting. Okay? Now, and that, as I said, that's what even was called the minimal version of Split Susie in 2005, 2006. When Savas and I wrote our paper, we definitely considered the possibility the scalars would be much heavier. Okay? We definitely considered that possibility. And when we did it, we had to start building models, okay? Because we had to explain why the anomaly-mediated contribution wasn't there. What you can do, you can build models with various versions of sequestering. If you're Marcus Luddy, you can build 10 of these models overnight, okay? And but it takes cleverness and ingenuity again. The whole point is not to be clever or ingenious. And so if you don't want to be clever or ingenious, just purely from the top down, we're not talking about massive splittings anymore. Now, forget about that. Now, just data. If the scalars are much heavier than 1,000 TeV, the Higgs comes out too heavy. Okay. So it's a really interesting spot. We can't make it too heavy. But if you want them to slide up to the place where they brainlessly solve the flavor problem, it just sort of puts you right in this region, 100 to 1,000 TeV. Now, that has an interesting implication also for whether you see gluino displacement. Let's say you really do want to brainlessly solve flavor. And by brainlessly, I mean brainlessly, right? The second, to my mind, there's even sort of 10% degeneracy here. Well, there's some mechanism for it. You have to come up with some cleverness and some explanation. I don't want to do that. Okay? I want to be stupid. If I want to be stupid, the first two generations should be thousands of TeV, a few thousand TeV. That has an interesting implication, because it means a third generation cannot be much lighter than 500 TeV. And that has, again, nothing to do with theories. It has to do with the fact that there's a two-loop contribution to the soft mass of any other mass, which, if there's a large log, would drive the third generation negative. If you put the first two generation at a multi-thousand TeV, you cannot imagine that the third generation is much lighter than a few hundred TeV. And that means, because it's the lightest of these squarks which participates in gluino decays, that means that it's going to be the stop, okay? Okay, so you have these top-rich decays with potentially displacement, and displacement is now it's hard to avoid displacement. I mean, you're in the neighborhood where you may or may not see it. If they're 200 TeV, you might not see it. If they're 500 TeV, you might see it, because they're right in that range. But you cannot imagine in this picture that they're 50 TeV or a lot lighter, because then the first two generations are not in the place where they're just brainlessly solving the flavor problem. There's a lot more I could say about flavor. Oh, I'm so tempted to say, but I don't want to say it. Let me just say something. There's a few people, maybe model builders in the audience, who once upon a time have played with the idea of generating the fermion mass hierarchy radiatively. Okay? This was the first thing I worked on as a graduate student. I absolutely loved these theories. It's a wonderful idea that you could calculate the ratio of fermion masses as factors of alpha. Okay? It's an idea with a rich history that goes back to Weinberg. And anyway, It turns out that the most natural way of running these theories is in the context of supersymmetry. Supersymmetry gives you all the ingredients needed to make this story consistent and even possible, but it's just impossible with low-energy SUSY, okay? Because you need flavor violations in the soft terms, which are so large that you're dead with flavor-changing neutral currents. But in this picture, you get to decouple flavor-changing neutral currents. They're gone as you go up to 1,000 thousands of TeV. But Yukawa couplings are dimensionless. They don't decouple. You can generate them at any scale. Okay? So this picture totally reopens up the possibility of generating the fermion mass hierarchy radiatively and having interesting signals for this physics up at the 100 to 1,000 TeV range from flavor-changing neutral currents. Okay? So not at levels that we've seen so far, but perhaps at levels a factor of 100 smaller. Okay, and there's a similar story to taking advantage of the fact that these things decay through higher dimension operators. This is an old story, but there's a few new things that can be said about this too. But there's a similar story for the electroweak guys, which probe the next higher scale, so that you could see directly that these things are decaying through higher dimension operators suppressed by more than 20, 30, 40 TeV or higher, from the nice fact that neutral Wino to Beano Z does not happen at leading order if the Higginos are heavy. What you get almost all the time is neutral Wino to Beano Higgs, which happens all the time, which is nice because here this could be the right-handed stop most reasonably. So here we have the Beano, which is going to decay to Higgs, and let's say the Wino at the bottom of the spectrum. So the Gluino decays are absolutely spectacular. You get two tops and a Higgs, and missing energy and potentially displacement. So that's four tops, two Higgses, net and displacement. So you just have to see these things, and the standard model background is zero. Sorry? I'm assuming the Wino is at the bottom of the spectrum. I mean, yeah, the Wino is at the bottom of the spectrum. Oh, sorry, yeah. I was talking about the vertex here, sorry. It doesn't matter. Sorry. So, and this rare branching ratio is a direct probe of where the next scale is, right? Yeah, it's an anomaly-mediated type spectrum. That's what we're doing. We're just now, but it's not anomaly-mediated because the Higgsino is heavy. So the Higgsino being heavy is a big order one perturbation on the spectrum. Okay, and in fact, it squeezes the spectrum a little bit. So the spectrum is not nearly as split as it is anomaly. Well, right. Oh yes, you solve all of that. Of course, you solve all of that. Right? Huh? Yes. No, you of course you solve all of that because that's all has to do with the fact that everything involving these guys are higher dimension operators. The things that split the neutral Wino and the UV contributions are higher dimension operators. Actually, the thing that splits the charge on the Wino components turns out to be a dimension 7 operator. The leading dimension 5 operator does not split the Wino and the Beano. So that's right. Then there's the calculable infrared piece, which is the usual alpha MZ, which is exactly the usual story. Okay, so that story is totally unchanged, right? Yeah. So there's even if you get charge guys here, you could even look for stubs and so on. That part of the story is exactly the same. But what I want to stress is that this is sensitive to. I mean, if I say this whole thing another way, if you integrate out the Higginos, you generate dimension 5 operators that look like this. You also generate dimension 6 operators. Okay. So the leading thing that makes him decay is this dimension 5 operator, but this dimension 5 operator only gives you this with Higgs in the final state. The only thing that gives you the Z in the final state is this dimension 6 operator. And so measuring a rare branching ratio to the Z is directly giving you a hint, a handle on where the next scale is. Okay. So, I mean, life is really good if you actually produce these particles because they have to decay through higher dimension operators, and then you measure the next scale in a whole variety of ways. Okay? So there'll be a paper coming out with some of these things in it at some point in the not too distant future. But okay. So this is at least my own favorite picture for what's going on at the weak scale, given everything we've seen so far. And now let me come back, finally, to say something quickly about Higgs properties. Sorry? Yes. Yes. No, not at all. Absolutely not. The crossing scale for tan beta dialed in, I can show you the plot. It's like, I can show you the plot. The scale up to which you can go where the Higgs mass at 125 GeV is okay. Yeah, it is not. It is around... in the standard model, yes, but I'm not talking about the standard model. Yeah, I'm not talking about, I mean, in this theory, it's if you want to zoom right in at 10 beta of 1, you can go up to maybe 10,000 TeV. And that's really if you dial straight into 10 beta of 1. From our point of view, there's no reason to be so close to 10 beta of 1. That's another accidental tuning. There's no symmetry enhancement. There's no particular reason to be close to 10 beta of 1. So again, 10 beta should be 3, 2, 3, 4. If it's 50, there's some PQ symmetry. If you have a, right. Yes. Not in this theory. Maybe in some other theory. Definitely not in this theory. Not in this theory. It's not the same as the standard model because there's additional stuff at low energies. There's gluinos at low energies that change the running of... What are you talking about?
The Gaugino
is always at a TeV. Yes, the Gaugino is always at a TeV. Yes, of course. Oh, yes, absolutely. No, absolutely. The Gaugino's are at a TeV. The Gaugino's are at a TeV because the lightest of them is the dark matter, or is part of the dark matter. By the way, just since you brought it up, since you brought it up, this is related to flavor. You might say, why aren't the gluinos also heavy? Everything is heavy. And then just hoof everyone up to high scales, right? If you do that, also keeping a picture that the soft masses are kind of random now, right? There's no reason for them to have alignment or anything special. So let's say the soft masses have reasonable off-diagonal components, okay? And now just make everyone heavy. You might think that's totally fine. It's not fine. It's fine with flavor chain neutral currents, but it's not fine with something much more basic, the actual fermion mass hierarchy. The actual fermion mass hierarchy is totally screwed up through these standard one-loop diagrams, okay? So let's say you have the up quark here. You have the sup. You have big mixing to the top. You have mu, H down star there, top left, top right, usual stuff. Big mixing here, to the right-hand and up, gluino, okay? This gives you a correction to the Yukawa coupling of the up quark, which is like alpha strong over pi, and then it's like mu m gluino over m soft squared, okay? So if you have big off-diagonal components, which you think you could have because everything's going to be heavy, that's fine, no flavor chain neutral currents, but you're completely screwed by the actual fermion masses that are all 10 to the minus 2 now, okay? All the Yukawa couple. Of course we could. Of course we could. No, absolutely. It could be. No problem at all. But I'm just saying something simple. That if you imagine that it's some simple U1 theory with, you know, reasonable off-diagonal components, everything is fine, Kibibo suppressed, again, nothing special, then you can't do this. Then you have to keep the gluinos light. Something has got to suppress the second factor. Otherwise, the Yukawa couplings come up too big. And then so there's some delta m squared over m squared here, left and right. This is a real formula. And that's just the facts, okay? So, of course, I'm not saying there's any problem with suppressing these, but I'm saying there is a simple picture where none of these things are particularly suppressed, then you can't just decouple everybody. Okay, you need to keep some people light and some. You need to keep either the Higgsinos or the gluinos light. Yes. 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 Well, it depends. This now depends to a certain extent on what you're imagining for the what you're imagining for the dark matter. If you want it to just be a relic, and the sort of we can talk about a variety of possibilities. So the very simplest possibility, which is also very very worrisome for this for discovering this spectrum, is that it's just a thermal relic. We know its bottom of the spectrum is 3 TeV. That's life. Okay. Bottom of the spectrum 3 TeV, it could be. Okay, it could be, and it I'm not promising anyone a rose garden. Okay? That could be the way life is. Now, there's a little something against it. A little something against it is that that really starts, if the bottom is a 3 TeV, it really starts pushing the scalar spectrum pretty heavy. And it starts pushing it heavy enough that 125 GeV starts being a little, and you start having to dial a little closer to 10 beta of 1. It's possible, but like I said, it's a little something against it. Yes. 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 Of course, we run the RG, of course. It's called the renormalization group equation. No, it most certainly is as simple as that. Yes, Ken Wilson taught us how to solve this problem a long time ago. It's called the renormalization group equation. Okay, we solve the RG for the quartic coupling of the top, and we run it at a matching scale, and we run it down, and that's it. Now, you might say it's important to do some parts of this accurately at two loops because of the contribution of the top Yukawa coupling. So that part is done at two loops. So we do it at two loops. We run the RGs at two loops. Yes. Oh, sorry. I just meant these off-diagonal entries. These are like flavor entries, off-diagonal entries there. Right. That's right. Yeah. Sorry. I shouldn't have written delta M squared. Okay. So let me just end by saying something about the Higgs. Back to Higgs couplings. So there was something that would completely kill this theory instantly. Okay. So forgetting about signals, something that would just demolish this theory, and not just this theory, but any variant of it. Okay. So, you can do any possible variant of this theory, and actually, there's a more general and interesting point here. I spent too long talking about this theory because I like it, but the point is, I think, more important. If we see any sizable deviation, in the properties of the couplings of the Higgs. In particular, a nice case to consider is if we see an enhancement in Higgs to gamma-gamma at the factor of 50% level without seeing much of a deviation in anything else, all of these theories are dead. Okay, full stop, no excuses, I meant that, no, nothing, just dead. Okay, and why are they dead? I mean, what I'm telling you is totally trivial. Okay, But the point isn't the little conceptual point. The interesting part is how the actual numbers turn out. Okay, so let's say you want to have some new charged particle running around a loop to modify Higgs to gamma gamma. Okay, you can definitely do it. But in order to modify Higgs to gamma gamma sizably, a sizable fraction of the mass of that particle should be coming from electroweak symmetry breaking. Right. That's, by the way, why you might have worried about the S parameter. Because whenever you get a sizable fraction of the mass from electric symmetry breaking, there's a big contribution to the S parameter. But the S parameter turns out to be totally fine. If it only gets half of its mass from electric symmetry breaking, S is okay, right? That's the flip side of the comment I told you I learned from Scott a couple of weeks ago, that Higgs gamma gamma is a stronger, wipes out LEP as far as limits on position electroweak goes. Okay. But you still need order one, half of its mass come from electroweak symmetry breaking, which means that it has to have a large Yukawa coupling, right? Now, imagine that it's a theory like this that we're talking about. Here, the only fermions that we could be possibly talking about are the these Giardinos. Actually, in the theory I just told you, it's so dead it's not even funny, because it doesn't even have any normalizable couplings to the Higgs. So completely forget that minimal theory. But even imagine we had Higgsinos downstairs. If we had Higgsinos downstairs, we could have these Yukawa couplings. That's fine. But you could work out in these theories, you never get more than a 15% enhancement takes the gamma-gamma, ever. Right? To get an order 50% enhancement, you need big Yukawa couplings that are comparable to 1. Now, these particles are all fermions. And this is the crucial part of the argument I want to make. If you want to imagine that there's an unnatural theory like this, okay? Natural theories you could do, it's ironic. Natural theories have way more freedom and unknown parameters and couplings than these unnatural theories do, okay? And the reason is these natural theories have tons of scalars lying around, and the scalars are the most promiscuous and least constrained of all the particles known in nature, right? So there's tons of couplings there we don't know about. But the second they're fermions, it's much, much more constrained, okay? So the whole idea is if the theory is unnatural, if it's like Split-Susie of this variety or any other variety, maybe there's extra vector-like fermions, maybe there's anything else, but the important point is all fermions. That is the important point. Sorry, the important point is that we shouldn't have any additional light scalars. Okay. After all, the whole point is that even the Higgs doesn't want to be light, but it's light for some maybe anthropic reason. You know, there's one tuning because it's important for life, or it's important for atoms to exist, or whatever. But there better not be any additional vectors, because they would have to be Higgs by something. There better not be any additional scalars, because they're obviously not important for our everyday life, because we don't know about them yet. Okay? So it would be weird, just wrong from this philosophy. I'm not saying you can't write down a random theory with lots of arbitrary fine-tunings in it, which has an arbitrary spectrum of particles. You could, of course, do that. But if the philosophy is that there's no scalars that are light, except for something that's absolutely necessary for long-distance properties, the Higgs, then the kind of spectrum we're talking about is the Higgs and additional fermions, perhaps. Okay? And that's it. No additional scalars or gauge bosons. That's the crucial point. And then you're cooked. You're cooked because by the time you make the Yukawa couplings big enough to give you the enhancements you need to Higgs the gamma-gamma, as you run the RGE to higher energy scales, they almost immediately drive the Higgs quartic negative. And you have vacuum instability right above your head. I'm not talking about vacuum stability up at the gut scale. I'm talking about vacuum stability at the TEV scale. Okay? And it's really a quantitative question. Okay? In order to be able to do it and get a 50% enhancement, I could show you a plot, but you guys all can look at papers and you know these things probably anyway. You really need charged particles lighter than 180 GeV. So these are eminently discoverable. Okay? Actually, it's a really important thing to rule these things out or look for them. Something you all know is that, roughly speaking, at the ATV run is pushing the LHC for the first time into electroweak production territory that's significantly past LEP. Okay? So we're also really going robustly past LEP even in the electroweak production world. So these things will either be discovered, very unlikely, or be ruled out. Okay? So if you don't see these very light charged particles, lighter than 200 GeV, let's say, then the Yukawa couplings have got to be so monstrously big that the vacuum stability is right above your head. Okay? And that means that all such theories are ruled out. Okay? The only way you could save them if there's additional scalars around that could turn the RGEs back around and so on and so forth. But that's a different world. That's not the world that we're talking about here. Okay? So these models make another very robust prediction. No change in Higgs to gamma-gamma at the 50% level, not even the 30% level. You see them and they're dead, completely dead. Similarly, if you see, that's not what the data is trending like, but if you see a modification in Higgs to BB bar, okay, at the 30% level, let's say suppressed at the 30% level, or enhanced at the 30% level, okay? That also kills these theories completely. It's for a similar reason. How could you do that? It's not a loop, but you might imagine you have extra vector-like states. These not loops, you have extra vector-like states. These extra vector-like states have Yukawa coupling. Say these are some heavy Qs and Ds. They have a Yukawa coupling to the Higgs. And these things, in turn, have Yukawa couplings to B and B bar. Through the Higgs. Okay. So this is again giving us effectively this is giving us effectively a this higher dimension operator coupling the Higgs to the B. And let me actually put some of these couplings here. This is lambda Q, this is lambda B, and this is some capital lambda. So this coupling is this capital lambda, lambda Q, lambda B. And now is the important point. This stuff, literally that coupling, exactly this combination, is, actually let me write this a little more. There's an MQ and an MU here, okay, for the mass of this thing and the mass of that in MD. Okay. Literally, this combination just repeated on itself, is constrained by R sub B for the left-handed couplings and for the right-handed couplings. Okay. So this and that, so that product is just sharply constrained above by R sub B. Okay. If you put additional structure in, like composite Higgs model builders with these fancy custodial symmetries in warped spaces and so on do, you could maybe evade this. But if you're not doing that, that is by itself constrained by R sub B for the left-handed coupling, that for the right-handed couplings. So exactly this product is sharply constrained above by R sub B. Then, if you want to get a big enough correction here so that you have a visible correction to the Higgs-BB bar coupling, that Yukawa coupling, again, it's a numerical question. You have to work it out, but it's got to be bigger than 1.5, and you're dead again from vacuum instability, exactly the same way. Okay? So either Higgs gamma-gamma enhancement kills these theories. If Higgs gamma-gamma goes away, but Higgs-BB bar is messed up at a 30% level, completely kills these theories. Okay? And I'm not just talking about the minimal versions, all of them. And it sort of reminds you how incredibly robust and powerful the standard model is. Okay, that you know, people complain about whether we get these rates correct to a factor of 2, but we have to remember that they could have been off by factors of millions in either direction, and the fact that they're measured to come out to within a factor of 2 the first time around is just astonishing, and the sort of consistency of the standard model and its resistance to you know, lame perturbations is rather striking. So anyway, so that's the story I wanted to say. To my mind, the Higgs at 125 GeV smells very supersymmetric. There's no theorem that it can't be a composite Higgs, but again, I would be shocked if it was a composite Higgs. Composite Higgs would have been much happier at 350 GeV, 300 GeV. 125 GeV is much too light for what a reasonable composite Higgs theorist would have expected. The Higgs mass, Susie wants it to be in the neighborhood of the Z. But, and this is the point, right? The point is that if you believe in a composite Higgs, or the Higgs is the pseudo-Goldstone boson, the biggest source of the breaking of the shift symmetry on the Higgs is the top Yukawa coupling. And so the Higgs mass should be set by the top mass. The Higgs mass does not look like it's set by the top mass. It looks more like it's set by the W and the Z masses. And the only framework I know of that makes that connection is Susie. Okay? It's Susie that ties the quarter coupling to the gauge couplings, and not the top Yukawa coupling. But it's not right where it should be. It's not lighter than the Z mass. It's sort of within smelling distance of what it looks like from a completely normal supersymmetric theory, but not exactly there. And I think the kind of picture that I'm talking about is what, to my mind, you know, makes it make sense. Of course, it makes it make sense. Yeah, right, I agree. Right. Sorry? Okay. Great. Okay. Have fun. Have fun building composite Higgs models, you know. Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. I can't disagree with your arithmetic. I can disagree with your physics rather vehemently, but anyway. that's what it looks like to me. And you know, if there isn't enough existing motivation for nailing Higgs couplings, I think we could just robustly, completely kill these pictures if we actually see a deviation at the 30%, 40% level in the properties of the Higgs. So there it is. You know, sticking our necks out and the, we had better not be seen.
So you talk about how to rule it out.
Yeah.
How do you rule it in?
Oh, rule it in. Look, life is, of course, if we don't see anything, other than the Higgs, life is hard. Okay, you know, you have to remember it took 50 years to discover the Higgs to begin with. So life. If we only see the Higgs, then we're in totally different territory of what we're talking about at the beginning. Can we measure higher dimension operators? Can we be convinced that we've seen them? Can we put limits on them, which at least tells us how tuned the theory looks or not? Okay. But I think in this kind of theory, you're really on a knife's edge of excitement. Because if you see these particles, any of them, it transitions immediately to a completely different than amazing ball game. Because not only do you see new particles, but you see a higher dimension operator. You know, it gives you a reason to go to 100 TeV. Okay? Because these things are decaying. If they decay at all, the next scale is not further than 100 TeV away. We study the decays. We learn a lot about what's going on. So, you know, it goes from being nothing to being like the next 70 years of the field, making sure that we go on to a major new energy scale beyond where we are right now.
Yes.
Well, times two. Yes. Yes. Well, yeah. I mean, we could. It wasn't the talk. It wasn't meant to be a talk all about the signals of the series. We could talk about it a lot more. So there's signals in Galeno production and decay, in Electroweakino production and decay, and again, the really interesting point is it's very constrained because they're decaying through higher dimension operators. So you get a very very constrained set of things that you can get. Let me give you a little random. So I mean, when Savas and I talked about these things a long time ago, it was only Galeno decay and displacement because that's the most dramatic thing. Okay, but there's many other things like that. I'll give you a small example. If you see flavor violation in Galeno decays, for sure the next scale is 100 TeV or higher, because you have this Galeno, it's decaying in this flavor violating way, so you close it up, it would give you humongous flavor change in neutral currents unless the scale is far away. Okay. Another example is, let's say you see Galeno decays again, you can determine whether if you have third generation decays, so if we have things with tops and bottoms in the final state, you can determine whether the things that are being exchanged are electroweak pure or not. I mean, so here's the question. You see a Galeno decaying, you don't see displacement, you don't see any of these, you see prompt decays, so tops and bottoms, charginos and neutralinos, and you want to know, are the stops just at 3 TeV right around the corner, we've just missed them with big A terms and all of that, or maybe are they at 100 TeV and so on. Well, there's a diagnostic way of distinguishing them, which is that if the things you're exchanging are pure, if there aren't big A terms, you only have three parameters controlling them, mq squared, md squared, and mu squared. Okay? Those three parameters control five possible final states, the tt bar, bb bar, wino bino, and tb chargino. Okay? So there's five final states determined by three parameters. So there's one relation between ratios of branching ratios. That ratio better be satisfied if what's going through there is electroweak pure. If that's not satisfied, you've killed these ideas, because the thing which is running there has a big A term in it. Okay, has something which is okay. So when you think about these decays in more detail, you can start getting more information. And like I said, the pattern of electroweakino decays is very interesting. If you see the Z and Higgs comparable, these theories are dead. Or the simplest version of the heavy Higgs-Zeno, is dead. Okay. So a smoking gun of the Higgs-Zeno being heavy is that the Z is the branching ratio to the Z is rare. Okay. But measuring that branching ratio tells you where the scale is, and so on. So you have to make them. Once you make them, it's a completely different ballgame, and I think it's a fascinating ballgame. And also, there's lots of potential signals because the scalars are hundreds to thousands of TeV. There's lots of potential signals in rare decays, flavor, EDMs. Not EDM, flavor, butyl gamma. I mean, potential flavor violations in future B factories, if anyone can convince me that the theoretical uncertainties can ever be brought under control, and so on. No. It certainly doesn't exist here. There's no mu on G minus 2 here. Oh, yes, yes. Absolutely, absolutely. I didn't say, no, I forgot, I didn't come around to your question, of course. What we talked about was the most depressing scenario where it's just a standard relic. It could be a relic and you could do something like that. It could be a relic and it could be well-tempered. It could not be a relic. I think it's totally reasonable for it not to be a relic. My student, Jared Kaplan's first project as a graduate student, I keep kidding him because I told him back then, and I'm telling him now, that it was a theory of the world that he wrote down. I asked him to work out the phenomenology of exactly this kind of model with late decaying moduli to dilute everything and, you know, and repopulate the dark matter, all stuff that people are very familiar with in the standard, in the context of ordinary anomaly mediation, but in this context of these theories with heavy particles. And yeah, and it's great. There's no reason a priori that there's still a preference for light dark matter, but there is. It turns out that you still need dark matter, actually a little lighter than what you're used to. It's not a thermal relic anymore, but it still needs to be, you know, hundreds of GeV. It can't be 10 TeV. It can't be as heavy as that. And it can dilute the axions. It can dilute the axions almost completely. Not totally. You can't go all the way up to the gut scale, but you're within, you know, a factor of 10 of the gut scale. There's a fourth root in the tuning that we're talking about there. So I really think it is totally fine. So again, it could not be a relic. It could be a relic, and it could be half axions and half this guy. No dilution by late moduli. It's also totally fine. You know, there's lots of ways that you could imagine the bottom of the spectrum is lighter. Let me just make one comment about the most depressing scenario with the 3 TeV Wino relic. Just to advertise, again, something that it's so important to get right that the experts around, it would be great if this calculation, which I've done, many people have done, but it'd be really good to be damn sure of the answer. It's a question of what the actual... If it's a 3 TeV, we know. What is the actual cross-section for direct detection? Okay? So this is a well-known story for people who have studied this. There's two diagrams that contribute. There's a 2W exchange and WW Higgs. Okay? If you're just a simple-minded guy and you look at the first one, either one of them gives you a cross-section that's 10 to the minus 45. It's okay. Okay? But the question is if there's any interference between them. And okay, so maybe it's been completely resolved, but there was some controversy in the literature about what the right answer is. And the reason it matters is it turns out that the second diagram would give you, with the Higgs exchange, would give you an answer with the same magnitude as the first diagram for Higgs mass, if I remember, of 135 GeV. Okay, so it's very important to get the sign right. Now, I believe, and there's a paper by Richard Hill, which I think did the best job of this that I've seen, and also my own calculation, it seems that it's unfortunately the wrong sign. Okay, so the cross-section goes down to 10 to the minus 47, which we'll not see. Okay, but, you know, if we're wrong, then it goes the other way, and it's 10 to the minus 45, and we will see. So I think it would be great if this was, you know, if more people looked at this just to make completely sure that that it's not 10 to the minus 47. But I'm pretty sure it's 10 to the minus 47, which is not happy news for direct detection. Then what we're left with, in that scenario of the world, what we're left with is some futuristic Arecherenkov telescopes that might see gamma-gamma annihilation from ACT. Yeah, ACT is our hope in this kind of framework. It's the gamma-gamma energies are too high for HESS, too high for anything else that I know of, so we'll have to wait for an ACT. That picture of the world is brutal, okay? But it doesn't have to be the way this works. And, you know, this is why you guys are doing experiments, so we actually find out. Yeah. That is a good question. There is a hope for that. There is a hope for that, but I have not studied it myself in detail. Yeah, I mean, that would help a lot, of course, but... It's right around the neutrino background. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Within the scenario I was talking about here, no, yes, certainly not. No, there's no reason for there to be any other scalar. The only reason the Higgs is around is because it has this job to do. Without the Higgs light, there would be no atoms. The universe would be, you know, totally different and so on. It's just, I mean, look, it's fine-tuned. I mean, it's just... there's no two ways about it. This is not what any of us thought or wanted the world to be like. It may not be this way, but the attitude difference is that, you know, mostly in model building, you know, I've done this for a living, so I know what I'm talking about, okay? There are these, like, you know, you're sort of tuning here and there, and, you know, you're sort of sliding things under the rug there, there, there. There's like sort of 10, 30% tunings all over the place that you don't talk about when you say, aha, this theory is so, it's so great. The idea here is just to be different. You know, it's just to say there is one tuning, there it is, but it has a job to do. The other tunings are so your theory isn't ruled out. This tuning is not for the theory isn't ruled out, it's so that there are atoms, right? No, so everyone is sort of tuning to some extent. Now, if you want to talk about whether 1% is better than 10 to the minus 4 is better than 10 to the minus 8, we can have that discussion. I would prefer not to because of the reason I said. It seems to me once you started tuning, you know, as they say, you've decided what kind of person you are, and now you're just haggling over the price, right? So I think, you know, if the theory was natural, then it could have looked like it did before when there was no haggling and it was as morally uncorrupt as possible. Once we're talking about tuning to some extent, then I think it should be the theory. It's ultimately nature that's going to decide. But kind of theoretically, I think we should think about what it might want to look like from the top down if we release this idea that it should be completely, totally natural in every way. And then if it has a purpose to do, like make us exist and make atoms exist and things like that, that seems like not crazy. Oh, no, sure. The second way of enhancement Higgs to gamma, if I wanted to reverse it, if we have an enhancement of Higgs to gamma at the 50% level, these theories are dead. But more than that, we learn something else new. There has to be some light vectors or scalars or something beneath the TeV scale. I mean, that's stupendously exciting, right? You know, forget about ruling these theories out. We're ruling in, you see, once you believe there's lots of extra vectors and scalars lying around, for damn sure it's natural. I mean, you know, that it's all the stuff that you would need to be there for it to be a natural theory. So we could say it the other way. We could say it more positively. So independent of how we say it, that would be the fact, as you know very well. If we see these big enhancements and we don't discover light charge particles, you know, by April after analyzing all the data, then, and if the enhancement is there, there have to be new vectors or scalars beneath one TeV. Fantastic. Singlet is great, no problem. Yes, actually it does. Here's a super dumb theory of baryogenesis. Moduli decay. Done. Moduli decay with order 1 CP violation, order 1 baryon violation in moduli decay. If one modulus decays at 100 TeV, and if one modulus turns into one baryon, it's a part in 10 to the 6.
You can do this with proton decay?
Yes, of course. Yes, yes. They're all higher dimension, very higher dimension operators, which is how they're decaying. But, I mean, they're suppressed by a high scale. But if you have one modulus turn into one baryon, then you get a part in 10 to the 6 for eta over s. The second you put in the usual loop and CP violation interference stuff, it's a part in 10 to the 10, and it just works. I think Hitoshi and Kitano and people had written down models like this, not in the context of the unnatural spectrum, but just, you know, with like late decaying moduli. So that, I think baryogenesis just works. I mean, in the sense that the 10 to the minus 10 number comes out, whatever, buried. Yeah, it's not hard to get. It's reasonable. Yes, yeah, and I think that's a very reasonable part of this story. I think that is a very, very reasonable part of this whole story, which is why I'm not so tied to the thermal relic. This is why Jared's paper was important. This is why Jared's paper was important, because, huh? Yes, that's right.
Right.
Yes, yes, that's right. They're all decaying somewhat before BBN.
So we can't.
Right. I don't know. I haven't thought about it as much as I should have. But I just want to say that this is why I thought Jared's paper was very nice, because a priori, once you have moduli decaying, you're diluting the initial dark matter abundance. It's not obvious that there's any reason, now that it's not natural anymore. You know, when you do it in normal anomaly mediation, you have another reason why all this stuff has got to be at the weak scale. In this context, there's no reason anymore why the particles have got to be anywhere near the weak scale. So I was worried, that's why I wanted them to do the project, I was worried that we would lose the requirement of having light particles to be accessible. And it didn't happen. I mean, it's just a numerical fact. But if you have late moduli decaying, diluting the initial abundance, repopulating it, you still need light dark matter. It's not the Witt miracle anymore, but it still does need to be light. And that is interesting. Yeah. Right. There's also an axion. In fact, I think that this is a reasonable picture that would lead you to expect 50-50, 10-90, you know, some funny combination of them. Yeah, everyone's happy. Yes, everyone's happy. Everyone's happy except, you know, Ken Wilson, who wanted things to be natural, except that he also, you know, wrote this famous paper 5 years ago where he said that in his famous paper on lattice gauge theory in the 1970s, he made three terrible mistakes. Two of the mistakes were kind of technical, and the third mistake, he said, was that he insisted that things would be natural. That's ridiculous, he said. Why should things be natural? The universe isn't a hunk of metal.